Citizenship and identity, and you'll see already that there's a bit of link to some of the stuff that we were doing last week on race and immigration, because as we said, immigration policy in this country has shaped the way we think of citizenship in many ways, and also a link to what we're going to be doing next week when we discuss race and multiculture, and specifically the idea of multiculturalism and the possible crisis of multiculturalism that some commentators are talking about at the moment. So I want you to see this kind of week as a bridge to from what we've done last week to what we're going to do next week. Firstly, we're going to be looking at the specific nature of British citizenship and asking ourselves a few questions about what makes British citizenship perhaps different to the way citizenship is conceived in other countries. Secondly, we're going to be talking about the working out of ethnic minority identities and what this whole thing about an ethnic minority community would be and where this concept comes from. It doesn't just fall from the sky. It's constructed in very historically precise contexts. Thirdly, we'll be looking at national identity, so something about what British identity would be about and what I'm calling the search for authenticity, so kind of a search for something that's essential about a Britishness, which, of course, there's a lot of talk about in the media at the moment. Fourthly, we're going to be looking at the concept briefly of hybridity and discussing what that might mean, and contrasting to the proposition that there's more and more segregation in British society at the moment. Are we more hybrid, transnational and cosmopolitan, or are we more segregated? What do you think? And lastly, we'll be talking about what I'm calling the new citizenship regime, and that's making reference to some of the stuff around citizenship tests and ceremonies that the government has brought in recent years as means, they presume, of increasing social cohesion. Okay, so what about British citizenship? I think it's fair to say that Britain has no clear concept of nationality or citizenship for several reasons. Firstly, unlike most countries, in Europe at least, Britain has no constitution, no written constitution. That's to do with the history of Britain and the fact that it's a monarchy. It means that it's difficult, there's nothing kind of set in stone, there's nothing written down about what Britishness is all about, unlike in other countries, and people who come from other countries will perhaps be aware of what their constitution is, whereas British citizens will know that there's nothing defined as a British constitution. The second point here is that there's no clear idea of national membership, and I think you all know what I mean here. Britishness is a kind of a weird constitution because of the United Kingdom, which is of course made up of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And a lot of the problems around defining a British identity is to do with the domination of Englishness as the kind of the hegemonic cultural identity within the United Kingdom. So often foreigners say English when they mean British, and there's that kind of confusion even amongst the English, who tend to assume that Englishness defines everything that the United Kingdom is about. So obviously if we add into that people who've originated in another country as immigrants or as members of the old Commonwealth, we introduce a fifth, if you like, factor that complexifies the view of what the United Kingdom is about. Thirdly, and this relates to what we said last week, so we won't dwell on it too much, citizenship, the concept of that, and immigration policies have been interlinked. And there has been little thinking out in Britain of something of citizenship as defined separately from immigration. Okay, so I just wanted to look a little bit more closely into this whole notion of citizenship and the shaping of British identity and the working out of what this citizenship might mean, taking into account all of the kind of the fuzziness around citizenship that I mentioned before. Right, so defining British citizenship is a kind of an ongoing project. It's a lot to do with what happened after the decline of the British Empire and what we can call a period of post-coloniality. This period, which begins with the collapse of the British Empire and the beginning of waves of immigration from the old empire into Britain, starts off this process, which I think is still under construction because we're talking about a relatively short history. What happens in this context of the decline of the empire, the growth of post-colonial immigration, is that British identity is constantly being defined vis-a-vis its outsiders. So those outsiders that come to Britain from these colonies that used to be integral to what British identity was all about. They used to talk about the sun never setting on the British Empire. When the sun finally set, it put Britain in a crisis of identity, if you like. The problem, if you like, for Britain at the end of the Second World War and the start of post-colonial immigration was that the outsider, who was originally in the colonies, was increasingly to be found at home, i.e. right here. So while British life was being transformed from within by the presence of immigrants, there was also an effort at the same time to try to work out what would be specific to a national identity, what would be specific to Britishness once the end of this empire had come about. Just to reiterate the point briefly, as we've said before, there's no such thing as a separate citizenship set of policies separate from immigration policies in Britain, and that's very different to other countries. What this means is that immigration acts come to define citizenship de facto by determining who could and could not belong to the nation. And this is pretty different to other European countries, as I said before, because most of them tend to have a much stronger idea of nationality and citizenship. In Britain, traditionally, it's always been a looser definition, if you like. Unlike France, for example, where there's a strong sense of civic nationality, or Germany, where there's a strong sense of ethnic nationality, in Britain, it's always been somewhere in the middle. English liberalism also traditionally, so the kind of the political ideology that has been at the bedrock of English political thought, has also had a more laissez-faire attitude to cultural and religious difference. So it's always allowed people to kind of do what they wanted much more than in other countries. All of this left the British government with a problem when attempting to define citizenship following the growth in post-colonial immigration. Immigration policy, therefore, as I said, came to define citizenship almost de facto. Basically, what I'm trying to say here is that because of the fact that the ways in which government has always responded to immigration as a kind of a moral panic, with changes due to globalization, over time the way we relate to immigration has always changed, and what that means for citizenship as in terms of how we think about is that it's always been very haphazard because of the way in which we conceive immigration changes constantly over time. Thirdly, as we saw last week, citizenship is defined racially because of the way immigration policy tends to divide between insiders and outsiders. We spoke last week about the difference between the old Commonwealth that were seen as ancestrally linked to Britain in a kind of a black-white divide and the new Commonwealth who were seen as being beyond that. Okay, so last week we looked a little bit at the different immigration acts and came to see how this idea of old and new Commonwealth, introduced by the 1962 Immigration Act, and the concept of patriarchy brought in by the 1971 Act, led to immigration policy being based on ancestry, a highly racialized, as I've said, conception of who could and could not belong to the nation. In terms of citizenship, in the 1960s and after the end of mass post World War II immigration, there was the belief that it was no longer possible to use this old kind of imperial conception of citizenship, which had this idea of a multiracial empire, so all of these people from different cultures, religions, countries living together under this kind of huge umbrella, that it became necessary to have a much tighter definition of British nationality beyond this. Okay, and as I said before, this was always highly racialized along black-white lines. What happens here is that the concept of belonging is introduced in the 1960s, which is a kind of a very ambivalent, you know, ambiguous concept that's brought in order to try to divide between who would really be British, if you like, and who would be accepted as being, could live here and certainly have the rights of citizens, but wouldn't really, in the public mind, be understood as being fully British. Okay? This concept of belonging is brought in to divide between, again, old Commonwealth and new Commonwealth, and really introduces, if you like, a kind of a bloodline conception of what it would mean to be a British national. Obviously, while this was being worked out in relation to immigration policy, by the 1960s and obviously by the 1970s, you already had a whole generation of people who'd come in during the first wave of post-war immigration, who were having kids born in this country, who were working, who were full British citizens by virtue of being members of the Commonwealth, but who nonetheless were being affected by this idea, by this discourse, that there is something about being really British, which means belonging to a British nation, and something which is kind of like not quite British because you don't fully belong. The idea is always that you belong really, in a true sense, somewhere else. So there's always this kind of ambivalence around immigrants, despite the fact being full British citizens, still thought of as being immigrants, and still were kind of worried that perhaps their allegiance might lie somewhere else, not fully with Britain. And I think when you listen to what I'm saying, you can think about a lot of debates in the media today where this notion is coming up again and again, this idea of not being really fully British. What happens in 1981 with the British Nationality Act is that this idea of belongingness is officially ended by bringing in a new concept of citizenship, which is called in the literature jus sanguinis. We make the distinction between jus soli, this is Latin, right? Jus soli, which means citizenship by virtue of being born in a certain land, okay? Which would be a civic conception of citizenship, and jus sanguinis, sanguinis meaning blood, which is citizenship by descent. And this is brought in formally by the 1981 Act. So what we do here is get rid of the ambiguity of the term belonging, right, and bring in de facto this law that divides between those born elsewhere and those born here. Basically, since 1981, you can only get British citizenship if your parents are also British, or if they have a legal right to reside here. So in the past, it used to be that just by virtue of being born here, you could have citizenship. Now that's totally changed. It's absolutely impossible. It introduces this idea of ancestry and bloodline directly into the concept of citizenship. So although, however, this idea of belongingness is formally gotten rid of in terms of the policy, you still have it there in the back of people's minds. And this is what I mean when I said before that we still have this conception that somehow your allegiance might be somewhere else. So we have always lived, if you like, with this idea of not belonging, perhaps not really belonging, and what that actually means for conceiving of living together in this one country. Yep.
You can get British citizenship if your parents are British, and what's the other reason?
If they have a legal right to reside here.
Right.
Okay. So moving on from this concept of citizenship, I want to introduce this idea of identity, because it's linked to what your formal possibilities are as a citizen. Okay. Firstly, I think it's fair to say that identity is a pretty problematic concept, but at the same time a very attractive one, in the sense that when I talk to many students, I don't know how people here feel, but when I talk to many students about what is interesting for them in terms of the whole, this kind of course that we're doing here, people say, well, I want to know more about identities, I want to know more about how that works. Has anybody here thought about that? Show of hands, are you concerned about identity? Okay, so not many people here perhaps, but generally speaking, it's something that attracts us. We want to work out what is this thing called identity. At the same time, it's a pretty problematic concept because we're not really sure what it means. So let's just look at a couple of different people and what they've said about identity. Firstly, and this might come as a surprise to you, I don't know, but identity actually means sameness. When you think about what the word means, it basically means being identical to something else. So we say I have an identical twin, for example, not that I have one personally, but somebody might have an identical twin because they are the same. Okay, they might look the same, but they share a lot of the same characteristics. So something is the same as something else, which basically means that when we think of identity in terms of community or group process, it's about being part of something in which we all have something in common. We all share something. And this idea, simple, right, but worth thinking about, of identity as sameness comes from the French philosopher Étienne Balibar in his work on racism. The other point about identity links to this idea of authenticity or essence, which goes back to Fanon, who we looked at in week two. Fanon talks about how having a shared identity is about trying to get down to the kernel or the nub or the core of what it means to have a certain culture or belong to a quote-unquote racial group. It's about finding what is really true about that. Fanon sees this as being highly problematic because he sees human beings as being very internally diversified and having lots of facets to their identity, but he appreciates that especially in the context of colonialism and anti-colonialism, what happens is that we kind of build this hard shell, right, which, if you like, conceptualizes our identity in order to present it to the outsider, okay? So we kind of build this quite essentialized, authentic view of what our identity is in order to be able to readily compare it to what is not us. And that's always what's happening with nationalism, if you like. This what is us and what is not us is very much part of identity building processes. Okay, lastly, identity is to do with the process of what Stuart Hall calls identification. Hall says, and I quote, that identification is always constructed through splitting. Splitting between that which one is and that which is the other. So it kind of relates to what I said before. It's always about identifying with something and not with something else. Okay? This is back, if you like, if you remember in week two when we spoke about Fanon and he talked about when he realized he was black. He said it was through the gaze of the other. Right? So this is to do with identification. It's not about only about what I identify as myself. It's also about the other identifying me as something and me, therefore, identifying with that thing that has been, if you like, imposed on me in the way that Fanon talks about blackness being imposed on him. Okay, it's not just an arbitrary skin color anymore. It's something with all those negative connotations that has been imposed on him. So the concept of identity, according to Hall, wants to create strict separations between groups of identified, i.e. same, individuals. On a national level, what that means is that identity is bound up with the idea of belonging that we spoke about before, and because identity is often racialized, it is hard to conceive of an idea of national belonging that is really inclusive of everyone. Sorry, could I just say, if you'd like to chat, you can continue that outside? Thanks. Okay, so in terms of the national essence and what we mean in terms of a national identity, Stuart Hall, once again, has, I think, a very neat way of conceiving of his view of identity. He says, I am the sugar at the bottom of the English cup of tea. I am the sweet tooth, the sugar plantations that rotted generations of English children's teeth. What does he mean by that, Hall? It's a weird kind of analogy using, you know, the typical English cup of tea to explain what his relationship to identity means. He's using it as an analogy to say that there is no such thing as pure identity. Post-colonial identities in this country are always and necessarily bound up with each other. The cup of tea, of course, refers to that, you know, very British pastime, drinking the cup of tea. But the tea itself, he says, comes from places like Sri Lanka and India that used to be British colonies. And the sugar that people put in the tea, of course, comes from the Caribbean, where Hall himself comes from. And there would be no tea without colonialism, and there would be no sugar without colonialism, is basically what he's saying. What that means, this is a metaphor, obviously, for saying that Britain wouldn't be as it is today if it had not been for the British Empire in the past, or if it had not been for post-colonial immigration today. But this is a two-way street. It's not just about what Britain is. It's also about what people who came to Britain from these ex-colonies experience. Because everybody's identity be they originally British or originally something else, is always and necessarily shaped through the coming into contact with the other, so that eventually there is no real and distinct other except in our discourse. So basically what Hall is saying is that this idea of creating strict and separate distinctions between different identities is a discourse, it's not a reality, because whether we like it or not, whether we're the most, you know, devout member of the British National Party or the most devout Muslim fundamentalist, for example, we are, despite what we think, necessarily affected by the fact that we live in this integrated world in which we all borrow from each other's cultures, traditions, and ways of life. And more so, the more we live together. I would also add that this happens on a global level more and more, as through the internet and international travel, we've come more and more into contact with other cultures. Okay, so who are these others that we talk about? Who are these so-called ethnic minorities that we like to talk about? The first thing coming from Hall that he says in terms of the construction of ethnic minority identity, if we can talk about something like that, is that there was a realization, he said, talking about his own life, that we weren't going back. He says that when he first came to Britain, he always sat on these mental suitcases. Basically, he had his suitcases mentally packed and ready to go back to Jamaica. But after about, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, people started to, and if anybody here has any experience of immigration I've had in my own life, I think you always, there comes a point in your life when you say, you know, I'm not going back, I am of here as much as anybody else. And Hall says that that was an important sort of political moment, a political realization. So what happens when the other, okay, this immigrant, if you like, starts to unpack the mental suitcases, is that at the same time as that happens, there is also the beginning of full-blown racism. Because when you have the possibility that these people are kind of here temporarily and they're going to go back, it was okay. But when people started kind of, you know, putting those suitcases away in a cupboard somewhere and, you know, saying, no, I'm here for good, right, then it also starts to become a problem for the so-called indigenous societies. So these margins, right, these people who were formerly on the margins, seen as temporarily here only, began to speak. They weren't just kind of, you know, getting about their own business. They also said that it's time that we start to think about constructing our collective identity in reaction to this full-blown racism, so in reaction to the practices of a racist society. Stuart Hall calls this Identity Politics 1, so the first stage of identity politics. What happened was that people who shared the experience of immigration, no matter where they came from really, began to mobilize in reaction to racism. They didn't want to accept any longer this idea that they were guests in a society that was willing to put up with them so long as they kind of kept their heads down and, you know, shut up. What they realized is that they wanted, if they were going to stay here permanently and they were going to be treated as the full citizens that they had the right to be, then they had to actually start calling for that. It wasn't enough to kind of sit back silently and expect somebody else to do it for you. It was just time to kind of stand up and start asserting their rights, especially in the areas of employment, education, against, you know, racist policing and things like that, because all of these things were becoming problems. We're talking about here in the 1960s and the 1970s. Blacks and Asians in Britain were very much inspired by the civil rights movement in the United States and later by the Black Power movement. Martin Luther King visited the UK in 1964 and really started off, if you like, the anti-racist movement around that time. And of course in 1968 his famous I Have a Dream speech was really an inspiration for immigrants and black people all over the world and also in Britain.
Oh,
see how this is really inspiring to people all over the world, and I'm sure everybody has seen this before, but it's worth reiterating. What happens also, as Hall describes it as part of Identity Politics 1, is that this idea of political blackness starts to come into common parlance amongst these newly mobilized, marginal others. Political blackness emerges at the end of the 1960s, as I said, in response to the civil rights movement, and especially to the rise of the idea of black power in the United States, and you can see also in Britain. Black is interesting in the way that it's used in this conceptualization, because it's not about skin color. It's not about something authentic that we can see on somebody's skin, but it's about identifying with a political category. For example, Irish immigrants, who are, you know, the largest ethnic minority group in this country, at a certain point in time, in the 1970s, when this was very current, began also to identify themselves as black, which might seem a little bit funny, because, of course, there are few black Irish people, although more and more today. But the point was not that. The point was that you were identifying with a struggle. Okay? Political blackness, if you like, stands against the idea of ethnicity or the idea of kind of strict and separated identities, as we said before. It's against this division into ethnic groups. It's all about unity. And it's a class-based analysis of racism, which sees something specific about the experience of people who are marginalized coming out of this post-colonial situation and facing a racist society. It's a shared fate, if you like, of the new black and brown and Irish working class. Political blackness had this kind of great unifying potentiality, Hall says, and other authors like Paul Gilroy also talks about this immensely in terms of its influence, especially in the 1970s and 1980s. But it has, of course, been criticized mainly by Asian scholars, people like Tariq Mudood, who says that, you know, political blackness didn't really speak to Asian communities and particularly couldn't take into account the specificity of religion because it was a highly secularist idea, if you like, that was about this kind of political unity but didn't try to kind of get to grips with the fact that people had different needs because different interests and religious identities, for example. Nonetheless, I think it's fair to say that it was a very important moment in the construction of the reaction to racism and the kind of the autonomous consciousness of minority communities in this country. So out of this kind of rejection, if you like, of political blackness, or at least the problematization of that, we have the birth of what we call ethnic minority communities. The unifying force of political blackness wasn't really ever shared across the board. As I said before, people who were concerned by religion specifically had a distinct problem with this idea. There were two factors that weakened the solidarity on the basis of a shared experience of immigration. And we'll be talking about those in greater detail next week, but I just wanted to kind of give you a hint of where I'm going with that. Firstly, the power of ethnic minority community leaders, and religious leaders in particular, was important here. Because the idea of political blackness, if you like, made the power over their own communities less strong, and they were less able to kind of, you know, have a forceful lead over each community, and preferred, if you like, the idea of each ethnic minority community being kind of self-governed in relation to the government at the top, rather than, you know, being unified across them. The second factor was that the beginnings of multiculturalism as a policy in the 1980s put the emphasis on culture rather than on politics. So the whole kind of analysis of racism, if you like, was depoliticized. But these are kind of what we'll be speaking about next week, so I won't dwell on them too much here. Ethnicity, if you like, is a really powerful concept because it allows both for internal organization, it allows us to kind of know who we are internally, but also for easy external identification. So it's easy for others outside to recognize instantly, okay, you are a member of X community, you are a member of X ethnic minority. So it's kind of a shorthand, a simplifying version of identifying people and, if you like, keeping them in their place. we can call identity politics too, okay, departing from the first stage that Hall talks about, goes away from the unifying force of blackness and embarks upon what the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor calls the politics of recognition. Taylor argues that full political participation demands being recognized by the political community as a whole, and he's taking these ideas from Hegel, but we don't have to go too far into that. He says that minority groups, long excluded from participation, are seen as needing to be recognized on the basis of their own particular agenda, whether that be, you know, religious rights or cultural rights, and certain traditions, etc. But this, you know, politics of recognition has been criticized for what I personally think is a very essentializing view of minority groups, because it sees each quote-unquote minority group as being kind of homogenous within itself, and there being no kind of diversity amongst all the people who are identified as members of the Muslim community, for example, or members of the Sikh community, or the black community, or even women, for example. I mean, we see, you know, certain people having the same problems just because, you know, they happen to come from a certain community. In a slightly different take on this identity politics too, the Indian scholar Gayatri Spivak, who follows Fanon really on this, talks about what she calls strategic essentialism. She basically recognizes that there might be a need at a certain point in reaction to racism for ethnic minority groups to consolidate themselves internally for what she says should be only a temporary period of kind of, you know, strengthening yourself internally in order to be able later on to resist racism more effectively, and eventually, it is hoped, relinquish this kind of essentialized identity and going towards a kind of a more diverse approach that recognizes the internal differences between members of different communities. But both of these approaches, the politics of recognition and strategic essentialism, are relatively problematic in terms of their tendency towards essentializing members of these groups. So we want to use them with a fair degree of caution. So again, on the national level, this kind of growth in ethnic minority consciousness from identity politics one through identity politics two leads to a kind of a questioning amongst the British elite, if you like, about where these allegiances lie, you know, these things that we said before about where are you really, where do you really belong? And it was Norman Tebbit, who was a minister under Thatcher, who in 1990 said, you know, he said a large proportion of Britain's Asian population failed to pass the cricket test. Which side do they cheer for? It's an interesting test. Are you still harking back to where you came from or where you are? What do you think he meant by that? What is it a metaphor for? Was he really talking about cricket? No? I think it's quite clear that what Tebbit was talking about was, you know, kind of a metaphor for where do you really belong? When it comes to the crunch, let's say Britain is at war against, you know, Pakistan, and you happen to, you know, have a grandfather from Pakistan, who do you fight for? It's these types of kind of essential questions about what it means to live here and be part of the society that Tebbit was bringing up. And you can imagine how this kind of rang true for a lot of, you know, quote-unquote indigenous British people who, you know, kind of manipulated by the media and by successive, you know, negotiations around citizenship, immigration acts and all the rest of it, we're left with, as I said before, this strong feeling that belongingness is nonetheless very, very important for how we define national identity. And knowing where you belong and being sure about that is incredibly important. And we can hear all of these things coming up again, especially in light of the 7/7 bombings and, you know, the apparent crisis in certain towns around segregation and the seeming total and utter misunderstanding between different ethnic minority communities, which is some of what we're going to be talking about next week. Okay, so this question of where are your allegiances, I think, is still a very, very important discourse today. Okay, it's as fresh today, if you like, as it was in 1990, and perhaps even stronger in many ways. Okay, so who then are we? I mean, to use the we in inverted commas. Who are these British people? In a sense, all this talk about ethnicity led to a kind of a backlash amongst white Britons, to use that very kind of essentialized term, who sort of said, well, we want to be ethnic too. Why are these people being so, you know, being given so much importance because they belong to ethnic minorities? And, you know, discourses in the tabloid press, the BNP, and, you know, to a certain extent, the, you know, mainstream political parties also led to this belief that somehow ethnic minorities are always jumped to the head of the queue when it comes to housing, always getting subsidies for, you know, different projects and whatever it is. And there's this idea, well, what about us, right? And more than being about Britishness, this is really about Englishness, because who suffers here is not, you know, Britain, because we don't really know what that is. It's something about the English, because especially post-devolution, right, the Welsh kind of know who they are, the Scots know who they are, but the English are kind of left there in the middle, sort of not knowing what their thing is all about. And this kind of, you know, problematizing of ethnicity has led, if you like, to a certain support, although it's not huge in this country, for some extremist parties, and perhaps, you know, certain of the agendas of, you know, the Labour Party and so on, when they talk about the need for national values and a debate about Britishness. So what is Britishness? Today, you know, this is kind of really on the agenda and people are talking about it a lot. There's this idea that we've kind of lost something and that we need to build this thing that we call social cohesion. But these are questions which I'm leaving you with. I don't really know how to answer them because I don't think anybody really does. What do you think British identity stands for? Think about this maybe and take that question with you to the seminar. And also, what would be British values? Because we hear this all the time. There's something about, you know, being British, which is apparently something specific. But when you actually have conversations with people and you ask them, well, what is being British? Often we don't quite know. The former Foreign Secretary, the late Robin Cook, had an idea of what he thought Britishness was about. And he made an analogy. I mean, you know, Tebbit talked about cricket, and Cook talks about chicken tikka masala, and he says that this is what Britain is all about, because basically Britishness is about being open-minded, being tolerant, and picking and choosing the cultural elements that you like from other cultures, because Britishness isn't fixed, and many people see that as a positive thing. But the question remains, of course, that, okay, fine, we like eating chicken tikka masala, but does that make us less racist? You know, are they the same arguments? Is the fact of being more culturally accepting mean that at the same time that something like institutional and systemic racism is really a thing of the past? One of the people that's trying to deal with this question is Hardeep Singh Kohli, the comedian who some of you may have seen on TV. And he has a pretty kind of fixed idea. He thinks, you know, it's my right to be British. My parents may have come originally from India, but it's my right to be British. And I don't see that at all as a problem. And it comes across in this little clip here that hopefully will come out. Okay, so his idea here is basically, well, there's nothing wrong with eating Indian food with a St. George's cross painted on your naan bread. Basically, he's kind of agreeing with Robin Cook here that we have to pick and choose what we like from what is, you know, the best of the various cultures. And that's his idea about where we're going with this. And I want you to kind of really try to think about this for the seminar. Unfortunately, we don't have the possibility to discuss it together, but it is a debate. I mean, is this enough? You know, is it enough? Is chicken tikka enough? It's a question. Somebody who doesn't think it's enough is somebody that Hardeep Singh interviews later on in the film, who's Aki Nawaz. Has anybody heard of him? He's a punk artist, a punk singer, and he was born in Pakistan, but he's lived here since he's a kid, basically. We'll hear that in a minute. And in the short clip that I'm going to show you now, there's this debate between Hardeep Singh and Aki Nawaz, which points to the divide between those who see Britishness as changing and for there being a place for all, which I think is what Hardeep Singh is trying to see, and those who basically see there being little change. Basically, Aki Nawaz's point is that there's, you know, racism is still there, and so what, you know, so what if we all eat chicken tikka masala? Nawaz's more politicized stance recognizes the fact that the emphasis placed on ethnicity and on identity by both the government and community leaders has led to the erosion for the possibility of a unifying solidarity around the experience of the shared experience of immigration, which there was a potential for in this concept of political blackness. He basically said this kind of, you know, this focus on Britishness and on ethnicity has kind of pushed us, you know, beyond the realm of politics where we can no longer act. Let's just have a look at.
Feels the same way. I'm going to meet a guy who's always been a bit of a hero of mine. He's a political activist and a musician who's always been big on bringing cultures together. So it seems a bit of a shame that we're about to disagree on, well, just about everything.
Ah, Sashi. Salam alaikum. Jesse. Again, to see you. Hello. This is Leila. Hello, Leila. And this is Mohammed.
Hello. Aki's family came from Pakistan to Bradford when he was just 3 years old. Aki's lived here all his life. But I'm not sure that he wants his kids to grow up as British.
Aki, do you regard yourself as British?
No, I don't want to regard myself. Why should I? Who tells me I have to be British to be accepted?
But you've not always felt this way, because, you know, you were a bit of the hero, a bit of the visionary to us lot that were coming up behind you, do you know what I mean?
You know, from my perspective now, I'm saddened. I'm actually saddened. I think that this country, this host nation, has really let us down. And it should be embarrassed. I'm not embarrassed. The host nation should be embarrassed. But we haven't managed after so long to kind of live side by side. And a lot of that blame has been put onto our communities where people said, right, you can't integrate, you won't integrate your cultures and all this. And I believe the issue is not our communities, it's Britain that has not moved on from their prejudices. And I don't want to be a part of their ignorance.
But if you don't feel British, then what do you have invested in this country? It's like being a tenant in a rented house. You know and I know. If you're just renting a place, you care about it less than if you own it. I think something that happened to me that sort of really set me off on this. I was in Soho, where I work in London. And as I walked by, I saw a white woman. She lit a cigarette, throwing her foil and the wrapping of the cigarette paper onto the ground. And I hate littering. So I said to the woman, I said, you know, it was easier for you to put that in the dustbin. And she said to me, F off back to your own country. Like, what, Scotland? We've got litter there too.
Yeah, but you know what she meant.
I know exactly what she meant, but that's my point. I need to say to people, no, I'm not from outside, I'm from here. And I demand this. I demand you to accept that I am from here.
Well, you can go on your, you know, you can go on your knees requesting that.
I'm not requesting it, I'm demanding it.
You know, no, you can demand it as much as we demanded it, and we went on our knees and we requested it. I'm not demeaning you. I'm telling you that our parents did it, we did it in our generation, you did it in your generation. There's two or three generations after us who were doing that and have done that, and all respect to them. But this nation does not want. When she said go back home, she didn't mean Glasgow.
I can't be responsible for how other people think unless I'm first responsible for how I think. I am British because I was born here.
Okay. You can want the need to be as British as much as you want, and I can accept you as wanting that, but it doesn't matter how much British you want to be, how much you're going to contribute, if it came to the crunch, you know, you're not British.
I have to confess, I'm saddened by the way Aki feels, but I can't disagree.
Sorry. you're supposed to wear it seamlessly. Okay, so just, I mean, we don't have time to go into it in great detail here, but just think about, again, you know, what was being debated there and bring it with you to the seminar. So kind of taking Hardeep Singh's side, if you like, many people have talked about the idea of hybridity because identity, if you like, is a process of constant negotiation. It's not one thing or another. Hybrid identity has been seen as a useful concept for making sense of this kind of fluidity of identity today. We are all global, hybrid, and diasporic. But this idea is also slightly problematic, as Robert Young, the post-colonial theorist, says. He says, all this talk about transnational, diasporic, and hybrid identities creates a new space of stability and self-assurance. And what that means is that some of us who are lucky enough to be transnational, global, and hybrid are kind of very cocky about it, if you like, but don't realize that we're kind of leaving a whole, you know, swathe of people behind, because this is also a class issue and what opportunities you have that make it possible for you to connect on a global level. One thing that is important, I think, to point out, which may mean that this is going to change in the future, is that Britain has the highest rate of mixed, so-called mixed-race marriages, and therefore children, partnerships, I should say, rather than marriages, in the world. And obviously that's going to change something in the future generation, so we might be able to talk in the future about hybridity being something very concrete. In contrast, if you like, to this idea of hybridity and much more sort of down-to-earth according to a lot of people, and what we'll be dealing with a lot more next week, is the post 9/11 and certainly, you know, the 7/7 bombings in Britain. The country is being painted as being a lot more segregated than ever before, with stronger and stronger conceptions of identity based on ethnicity, and in particular religion, taking over from both political blackness and British identity. So there is also a kind of a hardening of white identities, which is seen in places like Bradford or Oldham that had the riots in 2001, where there is apparently a kind of a segregation between minority ethnic communities and white British on the other hand. So there's kind of a coexistence and a mismatch between perhaps what's happening in large urban centres such as London, right, and what's happening in other places where this kind of global and hybrid identity is not really happening yet. Finally, there's a new citizenship regime which goes much more into the pessimistic view of segregated Britain, disunited Britain rather than the United Kingdom, than this more optimistic idea that we're all hybrid now and transnational. In 2006, citizenship tests and ceremonies were brought in. The idea is that if you want to be naturalised a British citizen, if you want to become a British citizen, you have to take a test in order to prove your Britishness and your commitment to Britain, knowing certain things about Britain that it is claimed that even British people themselves don't know. When I did this test with the students last year, we all failed it, including me. So, you know, we might ask, are we asking immigrants, you know, something that we don't even ask British citizens themselves? But nonetheless, more than what the test is actually really about, it's the idea that we're testing something called Britishness, which is very, very, you know, it's a new idea that we could actually essentialize this thing called Britishness and put it out in a multiple choice questionnaire. Can we really do that with something that's so complex, that is, you know, built on such a kind of range of histories, traditions, practices, identities, and all of the things that make up what, you know, one particular country is all about? Going along with these tests and ceremonies is this new discourse about British values. If you remember last year when there was the Big Brother, the celebrity Big Brother racism, you know, argument with Jade Goody and all the rest of it, Gordon Brown, who was in India at the time, ironically enough, said, you know, I don't want anybody to associate what happened in Big Brother with Britain, because Britain and British values are all about tolerance and respect for the other. So we have this strange thing going on where on the one hand we conceptualize Britishness as, you know, tolerance and respect for the other, but at the same time we're constructing stricter and stricter immigration policies to keep people out, which obviously give us the idea that there is less tolerance and respect for the other. So I think there's somebody knocking on the door. I'll leave it there with, if you like, I put one of those citizenship tests on StudyDirect so you can take it. See if anybody here manages to pass it. I'd be absolutely astounded if you do, and I'd be happy to hear about it next week. So, thank you.